This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. So we wanted to begin by inviting you to resonate on this extraordinary quote that comes from 1913 from the 25th annual report of the City Parks Association that Dina's going to read.
When a river flows through a city, its condition is not and cannot be created by nature. All its surroundings are artificial. The hand of nature has given way to that of man. The beauty of a municipal river depends on art and art alone.
And so as you can tell from that quote, but also as you can tell from even a cursory look at John Lewis's The Redemption of the Lower Schuylkill from a few years later, both of these texts speak about the relationship between man and the river as an artificial one. Both of them are interested in defining that relationship and developing a vocabulary for that relationship. And so to begin, we just wanted to really, in the simplest way, whether you answer it practically or theoretically, to ask you guys to talk about what you understand the relationship to be at this time as concerns the river, the city, your own work.
I just wanted to add one thing that I came across recently in the work of a kind of anthropologist and historian named Ashley Karse, which is the idea of natural infrastructure. And he has explored that concept in the context of the Panama Canal, which is a classic example of a big human construction, right? Building a canal across a thin part of a continent, connecting two oceans. And what he explains is that at some point it became obvious to the people maintaining the canal that it was absolutely necessary also to take into account the watershed that surrounded it, because without managing that watershed and engaging with the people who were farming it and were cutting down trees, the artificial infrastructure was going to collapse. And I don't think a concept like natural infrastructure is necessarily a resting point, a place where we want to stop. It continues to be a kind of hybrid term, which assumes that there's this thing natural and there's this thing artificial. And I feel like, in my experience as an environmental historian and historian of science, this is a moment, and maybe the past decade has been a moment of playing around with these kinds of hybrid terms, natural infrastructure, nature cultures, and so forth. And it all feels a bit temporary. It feels like a passageway to something else, something where those boundaries don't mean quite as much or don't stand quite as tall as before.
One from our perspective at the William Penn Foundation, one obvious and important factor there is that the city drinks the water from the river. So it's a source of drinking water, a source of life in a lot of ways for people who live in the city. And I don't think a lot of people realize that.
I mean, I think for me, coming at it as both as a designer and also someone who's very interested in analyzing and tracking and communicating the ecological systems in urban areas. I'm really excited that this dichotomy between nature and artificiality is being challenged on many levels, both through how we now perceive nature as part of our vital infrastructure for urban areas, providing services, providing things that we'd otherwise have to build very fancy engineered infrastructure for. And at the same time, seeing that we as people also intervene in natural processes and cannot be separated from those natural processes if we want to understand how those systems work in urban areas. And so really we're getting beyond this binary and getting into a really interesting hybrid condition, which I think parallels a lot of the discussions about the Anthropocene that are very exciting and push us further.
Yeah, I think, I guess if I want to make distinguish the humans from the natural world, I might say humans are, we've begun to realize that we're natural in a way. But maybe I would distinguish between human and non-human and then consider the river as a space of interdependency and really think about our need, and that makes me think about the sublime nature of the river and how terrifying it is and how necessary it is at the same time. I definitely think about, you know, times in my life where I've been deathly afraid to be on the water side of things. So,
So this sense of it being critical, we draw from the water, but the scale we know is that the water goes way beyond the city limits, right? And so the sense of scale, and yet when it goes through the city, we have tried to contain it. So this dynamic of control of the natural world and what you're saying, the artificiality of, or perhaps it's the condition of the human trying to somehow dominate the wilderness, right, continues to challenge us. Any thoughts about that, where we are now, before we jump ahead?
Oops.
Well, I think the continuing to challenge us, I don't know whether this is an answer to that question, but I think it's interesting that the recreational use and the drinking water use of the river, that people, to the extent people are aware of the drinking water use, comes from the dam, which certainly was a significant intervention in the river, and created the almost still water above the dam that people recreate on, which has become rich in nature in its own way, and then that's surrounded by Fairmount Park, which was an effort to preserve nature, or to recreate nature, I'm not sure which. So I think that going forward, there's sort of a playing that out again in the Lower Schuylkill now, that people are getting back to the edge, and it's sort of the understanding that there's some value in it to everyday life, but that opens up doors for opportunities to bring nature back, I guess.
I think it's also interesting to maybe redefine what kind of nature we want to see come back. And I think for a long time, there was a certain sense of you know, what is the proper nature? And mm-hmm. It came with questions of who could use that proper nature and who would pay for that proper nature. And I think it's fascinating to see feral processes of spontaneous vegetation and kind of unstoppable ecological processes taking over and undermining mm-hmm. Engineered vocabularies and engineered interventions. And at the same time, challenging us to ask, okay, so is this bad nature? Is it poor nature? Is it somehow deficient? Or is there value here that we have not yet culturally constructed?
Mm-hmm. Are we going to call it nature? Can we think about a different term? We were trying so hard not to use that word. So, because I think it's explosive. And Mary, I want to capture your response as well, but I'm throwing that question into the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just thinking about the domination question a little bit, and I think that we've come to the point where we realize that we are not able to dominate nature and we're not able to control it. The best we can do is work with it, and I think that we're still struggling to do that. To me, if I'm envisioning a future of the Schuylkill River, I kind of think, well, how can we work with this thing that is so already hemmed in by what we've made around it, and how is that going to affect our lives, because we've really put ourselves in a precarious situation. Can we make that better by allowing more space for the river to be the river?
Yeah, I'm pretty uncomfortable with the word nature too, and try to avoid it because of all of that baggage that it brings. And so, I don't know, maybe there's a vocabulary around ecological processes and cities' ecological flows. There's a question of hydrologies, pre-development hydrology, designed hydrology, different kinds of urban flows and urban, you know, post-natural conditions.
Post-natural conditions.
I want to push you guys to speak a bit more about all that you've just been raising. In an era of the Anthropocene, we're so attentive, as Dina was just asking us, to think about to how much we control ecology, how much we control nature. Each of you was talking about kind of in different ways allowing nature to reassert itself. You invoke the word feral, I think. Mary has invoked the word like coexistence and allowing the nature to kind of return it in various ways. Are we not, as Dina was saying, romanticizing nature in this moment? Isn't I mean, I know that you guys were just speaking to this, but isn't the relationship so artificial to the river? That's what our predecessors have given us, right? That's what we find in this annual report from 1913, or John Lewis's. We find an argument that the relationship is totally artificial, and it cannot become natural. Be romantic to think it couldn't revert somehow. And so, I don't know. Can you guys just speak at greater length? Maybe
can you define artificial? I'm not sure what that means in this context.
Yeah, I suppose that in this particular context, at least historically, they're recognizing how much the river has been shaped. Both by planning and in other ways, so that the river itself is not charting a kind of an organic development through the city. Rather, the city and the river together are remaking each other perpetually, and it is constructed all the way down.
And you see that especially in other countries throughout the world where the rivers really inform settlement. You know, there are examples of that.
Right.
Here in the West, there is the sense of, and we're containing it by creating the edges, right, of the Schuylkill, or we try, along the banks of the Schuylkill at least. Yeah.
But the river itself, I mean, the water's not artificial. The water still behaves the same way. It's just that it's constrained. So I think there's a constraint that's not artificial. The constraint may be artificial constructions. They're not natural construction. It's not a natural course, but the river still flows, and the dynamics are still the same in many ways.
Doesn't the water register industry and kind of the remaking of landscapes?
The pollution, industry? You mean? Polluted water?
Through pollution, like, isn't the water in and of itself something, again, that registers our touch and our hand?
But I don't think that makes it artificial, though. I think that makes it impaired or tainted or something, but it's still the natural flow. And if you're on the water, you feel that, and you see it.
I think also the impact, you know, if we're going to call it, you know, no longer pristine or somehow impacted, that impact extends far beyond, you know, the embankments that run through the city, and you know the dam is a huge part of that, and kind of how that alters tidal flows and the inputs that happen out in the suburbs. What that river is consisting of, the extent to which we've channelized urban creeks and streams, and the different, very different soil that the city now has, the suburbs now have, the different ways that biology interacts with that soil, what those interactions then do to water that's flowing towards the Schuylkill. I think the river is not an object, but actually is a collection of all of these flows as they come together. And so I don't think we'll ever unmake that.
Right.
And for me, it's exciting to think, okay, now that we're here, what do we want to make again, right? And it's the same way that I love thinking about the disappeared white cedar swamps of the Hackensack River. Because, yes, they were cut down, but they'll never come back because we've altered the salinity of that river. And so if we want to bring back a new nature, we have to reimagine it, and we have to do it in consultation with our cultural narratives and desires, fantasies.
Wow. I think that's a beautiful notion, and I also really like the notion of water as being storied and as being this an element that carries our stories and other non-human stories with it as it travels. I guess in terms of thinking about new languages, I've been raised in the United States, and I think about everything in an economic language. So I think, you know, I've grown up in a war economy. I think about that. I think about the fact that I've grown up taking from that economy. I've grown up as in a taking economy. And what if we could change this to a giving economy? So when I think about the rivers, I think, I've taken from the rivers all my life. How can I now give? And that's the narrative that I'm really interested in thinking about as a future narrative for our rivers.
So, and it's interesting because you're all working, it's across these different scales. We're working across different scales, economies, legal constraints, and personal stories or personal connections. So can they all coexist? Do you think? Can they coexist, and are they all compatible when we think about going forward? Especially as we think about the length of the river, that it goes beyond Philadelphia, you know, from right. the north, from the headwaters, all the way into the sea.
I think the scales probably nest, and that there's a series of different sets of concerns. And so there's policy implications that can affect entire watersheds, and there's localized interventions that might change a bulkhead in order to allow access that wasn't possible beforehand, and that there's just they telescope in and out in terms of the new relationships that can be made vis-a-vis that river.
Yeah, I guess they've all been coexisting for so long that that's kind of the only option.
Yeah, I think that there's a science element to this. So, I mean, I think we understand more about the condition of the river, and we understand more about what not to do and what to do to try to restore. And then there's the policy overlay is that there are good things happening, but they're happening in sort of an isolated impact model rather than sort of collectively. So I don't know whether that can ever add up to tremendously positive impacts, but I think probably they can, which is what we're trying to do with our grant making. There's something about, I spent a lot of time on the river in Philadelphia, and the presence of birds and the presence of people and the obvious plant life, and whether they're invasive exotics or not, there's just so much happening that has a very positive feel to it, that it just feels, especially with the city and the bridges and the water flowing, and it just becomes this really significant presence that's not changing in a lot of ways. And it's very alive.
We're really lucky. I mean, in the first conversation we had in May, we were with many historians who reminded us that the Aiken's images were completely romanticized, that, you know, the rowing, the sculling was being done on basically a river of sewage. Now you can scull and not be on a river of sewage.
Right. So I wanted to kind of stay with this discussion of how you guys are each working in across different scales and whether there's something like coexistence that could be possible with the river. I guess Dean and I were also interested in how you guys are each working in profoundly different ways as artists, as mm-hmm. as funders, and mm-hmm. as individuals who are trying to influence policy, as educators and as designers. And each of those ways entails very different understandings and conceits. Some privilege the small or the informal. Mm-hmm. For instance, in our artistic economy, often there's a very different ethos than that of kind of the more formal approach that funders often mm-hmm. have, that are focused more on questions of policy sometimes. And so those, at least from where I sit, those often seem to be in tension in society. Is it the case that, like, somehow when it comes to the river, these all perfectly coexist? Mm-hmm. Or do these different kind of methodologies, the different conceptions of practice, do these tensions somehow, like, just disappear when it comes to this particular body of moving water? So.
No. In fact, kind of the way we started this conversation with questions of naturalness keep cropping up again and again. I find it really important to go back, you know, working with students, kind of working through this idea of, well, you know, what does natural mean to you, and is it a value or a moralistic judgment, or is it a description of component parts, or, you know, how do you operationalize that concept? But, you know, in landscape design, I feel pretty lucky that there is not kind of a set scale, and things can really jump around between something that's very large urban planning or even regional planning oriented versus something that's highly spatialized, highly detailed, and extremely specific. And so oftentimes we're playing with geography, but at the same time we're playing with cultural conception through image making and representation.
Can you say a little more about that?
Well, I just think, you know, there's certain analytical modes of dealing with regional planning issues, you know, whether it's urbanization or transportation planning or tracking pollution, that that really need to have a certain scale in mm-hmm. order to be to resonate, because you're never going to control the specific outlets on every single street corner or every park. And then there's these moments which have a lot of cultural resonance. So for example, Market Street Bridge, where it meets the Schuylkill Banks, a lot of people pass through that point every day, and you can start to operate on people's conceptions of, these questions of urbanization or questions of their relationship to art or to nature mm-hmm. or to their memories, and try to influence those narratives with things that resonate with what they might experience. And those can be very specific and mm-hmm. spatial and architectural mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. art-based.
That's very... reflects the way we've approached our funding, actually, that exact way, sort of recognizing that a large foundation, even a large foundation that's trying to address protection of a river or a system of rivers, can't do everything everywhere. So part of it is a policy solution, but part of it is working with conservation organizations who tend to work in their own place and think that their place is the most important place. But if you have an understanding of the science of the system, go to the places where you can have an intervention, conservation intervention that can make a difference in terms of restoration or protection, and then tell the story about that in a way that people realize that there's more that has to be done and can be done, because you can't possibly do it all. Mm-hmm. But that's the way you described is the way we are trying to approach things as a grant-making organization.
I just have a little bit to add to that, because my experience is pretty different. The water in this river even is very bureaucratic, so working within that is something that needs to be collaborative. And I think when I first started working on the water, I thought it was a free space, and I was very excited about less rules and thinking about not having to deal with the Department of Buildings, for example, yet there are all these other departments that all have their say in the waterways. And I also think that because of that, it is very collaborative, and it's collaborative to work on the water on a boat. It's, you have to be working together, because it's a moving space. Yeah. So I think that's what I have to add to that.
So I want to jump to this question, and then I want to see if you guys have questions for each other, because you might. but so imagining for a second, there are lots of examples of studies that have been done where if we look ahead, the river is producing food, or we're living on it in the way that Mary proposes in wetland, or perhaps capturing energy from the sunlight on it, and then that dynamic of what the water is or not changes in its relationship to our lives within the city itself. So those are some things that have been thrown out there, but I'm interested in fast forward and imagining that urban river of the future, and whether anybody has given thought to that, imagining what that might be. In the largest sense, as well as the smallest.
Well, I've thought about this. I'm worried about climate extremes, and I'm worried about temperature extremes. And I do think that, if we had the ability to do anything, if money was no object, and if we could redesign our rivers, not that we would want to, but in this future scenario we do, I think we would make them less deep, shallower, and then we would allow them to spread out a little bit more. And that would regulate our temperatures more, and that would we would have less extremes because of all this runoff going into these deeper rivers, going right out to the ocean. So that would be my dream for a future city where we didn't do anything to it, maybe.
So the river and its bounded kind of identity today would dissolve and be replaced by something more fluid and organic.
Well, that's definitely we've made such flashy streams and such flashy rivers, and as rains get more extreme and further apart, I think that'll only exacerbate the flashiness of urban waterways, and so you'll have a lot of flooding, and then maybe you'll have very low water for a long time and a lot of flooding again. So I think we're going to really need to re-engineer both the flood defenses and the natural systems in order to accommodate these new conditions. I think probably some of the best work around urban rivers has been going on in the Netherlands, where I mean, they're very exposed, first of all, to flooding, and you know, they've kind of made this decision that they're going to acknowledge that they've overbuilt, that they've penned the rivers in too much, and now through a program such as Room for the River, they're trying to carve out new spaces which are not entirely natural. They can be agricultural or they can be urban. They can be plazas, they can be cisterns, they can integrate urban fabric and street infrastructure, but they're making concerted efforts to bring back room for that river, give it more room to flood, give it more room to soak, slow it down, and make use of it. New Orleans is really having to think through this as well. We're pretty lucky in Philadelphia that we're not, you know, exposed to coastal storm surge, which is great. But there's all these other things that, you know, we can start to pre-adapt as we can expect our climate and our hydrology to keep changing.
It seems like Philadelphia is doing a lot already, right? They're doing, there's a pretty robust rainwater collection system, and permeable pavement is almost everywhere.
And from our perspective at the William Penn Foundation, we do look at the whole watershed to the whole Delaware watershed. And so looking forward, what I would hope is that the upstream-downstream connection is something that policymakers and others think about. I had an experience a year or so ago in meeting with some people from Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania, who came to Philadelphia to see us to request funding for work up there, and in the course of the conversation said, in Schuylkill County, we say, two flushes for Philadelphia. And it was sort of like, oh, really? So I think that there's a lot of positive that's happened over the last 40 years because of the Clean Water Act, but the river, the Schuylkill and the Delaware are at risk from a death by a million cuts, from loss of forests, additional paving, things happening all over the place. And how do you begin to control that if you begin to realize that what I'm doing up here is affecting people down there? That is one way to get to that. And another part of it is being sure that people crossing the Market Street Bridge or experiencing art on the river really understand that not being on an open sewer is why they can enjoy what they're doing.
So we've been talking about utopian conceptions of the river. You've just mentioned some of the concerns that we might have towards the future. Could you speak a little bit about the dystopian future? I mean, again, you've just been invoking it, but not to necessarily raise the rhetoric of crisis, but you know, what could be the other scenario?
Toledo, Ohio, or West Virginia, or wherever drinking water supplies have been contaminated and people can't drink the water, and it happens.
Yeah, I would agree.
There's also, you know, this question of how does our energy supply mix with our water supply? And yeah. These processes are complicated, and at the same time, they are interconnected on mm-hmm. fundamental levels. And so from the amount of water that is being drawn to frack wells in Pennsylvania to what then happens with some of those headwaters as they make their way back towards the city, I think it's just something to be very watchful of and very aware. You know, the water department needs to care about what happens, you know, way out in northeastern PA, not just what happens within city limits. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a potential dystopian catastrophe that could be on the horizon if we're not careful about our energy development as well.
So I want to throw out to the panel, to each other, whether you have questions for each other, and maybe while you're thinking about that, also throw it out to the audience that's here. If there are any questions, we can bring the mic to Mike. Do you mind me?
So I've been sitting here thinking that we're in a cultural moment that all of us are a part of. So if we look back, let me preface this by saying I take a walk every morning in the Woodlands. And I look at the bend in the Schuylkill that, you know, you must have come up and seen something totally extraordinary when you saw that mansion on top of the hill coming up the river when you take the bend from Bartram. But we're in a moment where, if we go back, we look at, you know, little enough, but we go, let's say, to the industrial city and the development of the industrial city, and we look at the sort of foresight of Fairmont Park, and that, you know, that is above the fall line in along the Schuylkill, and it took a lot of forethought to do that, and it's a pushback to the industrial city. We look at 1952, and we look at sort of the Robert Moses idea of transportation, which had an extraordinary sort of impact on both the city, but also on the river, especially in Philadelphia, and now we're in a different cultural moment. And we're in a cultural moment in which we're looking at the city in a different way, which I think is driving many of the things that we're talking about or that you're talking about. And I'm wondering what you all see as that cultural moment. I mean, Andy, I feel like I know a little bit more about yours, which is, you know, I see this extraordinary moment where you guys are trying to connect everything, and you're trying to, even the circuit is one of the circuit of trails. So we're in a different cultural moment. What is that, and how is it driving what we're doing and thinking about right now?
I think one of the big cultural moments right now is this transition from an industrial society to something that we're not quite sure what comes next. I think you see it here in Philly with the refinery, for example. You know, should we care about the jobs, or should we care about bringing, you know, something besides that here onto the river? You know, should we... There's a greening of cities that's been happening for the last several decades as large industries leave and kind of society debates what to do with that leftover parcels. And I think right now we're seeing some indecision where maybe we do want to keep some industry, and maybe we also want to make some residential. Maybe we also want to create some new ecosystems that, you know, haven't been there for 150 years. So I think there needs to be this give and take between economic forces, between advocates and conservation groups, and between kind of visionary urban designers who can give us, you know, various scenarios of what might what we could have if we want it.
I think we're in a precarious situation where, you know, we're in a precarious economic and environmental situation, just to name two, and we are at a point where I think a lot of people realize that we do need to work together, and I think, you know, that's why we're sharing like this, and I think the moment. It's we're not working separately against each other anymore.
Can I just say quickly that the cultural moment of rediscovering waterfront because of receding industry or whatever, but I just was at a presentation about Penn's Landing and the great things happening there, and there was an entire preservation, and no one ever mentioned the fact that the reason people want to be there is because the Delaware River's clean, and that never came up. And I hope that as people rediscover, which is what we're trying to do, waterfronts, that they're mindful of the reason that it's rediscoverable.
Thank you for such a thought-provoking discussion. One of the thoughts that this has provoked in my mind is, lucky us that we are in a position to be able to reconsider the river's future. And I think when you spoke to industry leaving, and, you know, the part of the reason that we are able to have this conversation about reimagining the river is because the industries have left, but they had to go somewhere else. And so it's a fairly privileged position that we're in now to be able to consider what we do with, now that they're gone. And I wonder what our responsibility is to thinking about where those industries have gone. Does that impact how we move forward now that the water quality and other impacts are somewhere else instead of here?
I think that's a really great question. I think that that's what we should be striving for, is to figure out how we can not only just take in the space around us, but to really consider the entire space and all the uses and all the inputs and outputs of you know, what goes into the city, what we use, and then where it goes after. And that would be, I think, if we could think of things in a full picture like that, I think that's where we should be focusing our attention.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. You know, thinking both of the inputs and outputs in our environment, but also, you know, of these places that we use by virtue of relying on for our consumer goods, for example, or our cars or our raw materials. And I think, so for me, it's important not to just build awareness of people about their nearby nature, but to build awareness of environmental processes that are common to urbanized civilization and to start to get people just to be more environmentally legible, environmentally literate, you know, as they think about where their products come from and maybe start to change their consumer behavior or start to advocate or put pressure on certain companies to change their practices. And really it's about being kind of informed and tracking those flows, those inputs and those outputs.
I agree with both. I'd add that the environmental movement itself, especially local or regional environmental organizations that celebrate rediscovering rivers or protection or restoration locally, that part of the story that something that was there went to India or somewhere else where they have no regulation and where they're doing really bad things is not woven into the fabric of the story they talk about when they celebrate the reclamation here. So it would be an interesting proposition for environmental organizations to do that in some way.
And Christina, just as another aside, I mean, here we are trying, we're really challenging the panel to come up with new vocabulary, which I don't think we've really risen to that yet. But we've talked about a new vocabulary around the river and the waterways and their relationships to the urban fabric. And perhaps there's also this new language for something we don't know what it is yet, that post-industry. Although I don't think it's completely post-industry, maybe it's Mezza post-industry or something like that.
Or it's industry that's moved somewhere else.
Well, or what is it actually that we're able to create goods manufacturing? And what does that look like? But the vocabulary is going to come from that particular activity, whereas I think when we're talking about waterways or this, in quotes, the natural, whatever that means to each of us, that perhaps we have the opportunity to think of more broadly. We can think a bit larger about that particular vocabulary.
Should I take a question?
Actually, just a short thought on that, which is that I think actually, even though industry left in kind of rapid succession for the last couple of decades, and we have had this moving back to rivers and coasts, you know, rivers and industrial waterways. I think the industry that's stuck around isn't going anywhere for a while. And in fact, there's now a big concerted effort by cities like Philadelphia to keep their industrial base. The PIDC is very protective of their industrial waterfront that's still around. At the same time, they're amazing natural moments in that industrial waterfront that's privately owned. And so I'm really interested in this idea of, you know, what are these temporary natures that we know are going to get redeveloped for, you know, train yards as Marcellus shale starts moving by train, let's say, or as the back end from North Dakota starts to become more a part of our local grid mix. But what can we do in the meantime to make those pieces of nearby nature perform for us ecologically, perform for us socially, and then maybe go away and crop up somewhere else?
Okay, a word I haven't heard come up in the conversation today is education in the sense of public, the vast public education. There are persons going across the Market Street Bridge or on their way to Drexel or Penn, but there are also people on their way to just anywhere in West Philadelphia. Or we have a terrible situation with our schools. We see people who they drink a bottle and they throw it in the water. They throw it in the streets. And where do we start with that? Because it can't just be the elite and the intelligentsia, which is important for policies, but you have to have people who are going to vote to support the policies.
Actually, I think I can answer that, and then I'll pass it to Andy, which is that we're really lucky to have an amazing watershed department at our Department of Water that has an extraordinary education program, and of course the Waterworks Interpretive Center. And we all just need to be educators wherever we are, cover as much as we can, I think. Did
you want to add? Well, I just add that it is true that there needs to be broad education, but I think even that has to be approached strategically, because there is no such thing as the general public. Everybody has some niche or interest, so how do you reach different groups in different ways? And you can't do it all at once, so if you can't, where do you start, and then how do you sort of expand? So that's, and I would just say also the water department's great, but the programs they have in schools and at the waterworks.
So I want to go back and ask the panel something so Etienne can pitch in something here. And then we want to leave time for people to mingle, right? Or am I jumping too quickly? Have we begun to think about a new language for these things that we posed at the very beginning of the conversation? Is there a new language? It's obviously the world of that of nature. When we use that word, we're all hesitant about that. We're using this term. We understand what rivers are, whether you think they're artificial in the city limits or not. They are different if they're contained. So is it, have we come up with some beginnings of new vocabulary or not? I mean, do we still have a long way to go?
I'd be more interested in coming up with, I don't know whether it's the vocabulary, but it's the way of doing things. So it's the action that I'm more interested in. And maybe more effectively understanding that systems are connected and that people in one place, actions affect people in another place. And so I don't know whether that's a new vocabulary or just more effectively using the existing vocabulary.
I would completely second that. I think it needs to be a vocabulary of systems. I think oftentimes, you know, there is a very clear connection when pollution is visible and highly, highly concentrated. And then when that goes away, when the rivers don't run yellow anymore or bright blue or, you know, bright red, it takes a lot more work to see environmental damage happening, and it takes a lot more education to understand the complexity of the intermingled systems at work that then start to affect water quality downstream. And so I think understanding the systems at work, understanding how they interact with one another, understanding how our behavior impacts those systems, and understanding that, for example, flushing the toilet on a rainy day is not the same as flushing it on a sunny day. Why is that? And unless we start to understand both constructed and natural systems and how they commingle with things like our aging infrastructure and how bacteria are able to handle or not handle certain pollutants in digester tanks, I think we will miss the big picture. It's not just about the litter, it's about those microorganisms and those chemicals in that water.
I think I'm also going to revisit something from the 1950s. Sir Clancy Winthrop wrote The Eco-Economy and pretty much requested that every country's GDP include the ecological and the environmental harms. So that would be an adjusted number. And I think, of course, it miserably failed at the time, but we might be coming closer to a time where it doesn't.